Okay, in case you didn't know, now you know, she thinks. So last time we talked a little bit about, we explored the idea of a person putting themselves in risk in order to save someone else's life, whether that's permissible to risk your own life to save someone else's life. That was what we talked about last time. That's a very relevant issue in times talking about corona, as far as doctors putting themselves in potentially harm's way in order to save the lives of other people. So that's got it. Okay, so that's what we talked about last time. What I want to, focus on today is on the question of triage. So, meaning, we have you have two people come into the hospital. You can only save one of them. What do you do? Right? Ideally, normally we say you would want to save as many people's lives as we possibly can, but there are certain times that you can't. And so the question is triage. How do we make that decision? How do we make that call as to whose life we save? So that's what we're going to focus on tonight. Any preliminary thoughts? And anyone have any thoughts about what they think should be when you're dealing with a case of triage? Two people come to the hospital, only one can be treated. How you make that decision? Anyone have any preliminary thoughts before we jump into any sources?
Can't decide because who's to say whose blood is redder?
And therefore what?
Flip a die or roll a die.
Therefore both would should die?
Roll a die. Flip a coin.
Roll a die. Okay, flip a coin, roll a die. You can't make the decision, so we'll let quote unquote fate make the decision, or God make the decision.
Are they showing up at the same time?
Let's say they're showing up at the same time. We're gonna get to next time we're gonna talk about, let's say they come at different times. But today we're gonna
Okay, so then
assume
I
same
don't
time.
have an answer.
Assume different times. What do you say for that?
Then whoever came first.
Wait, yeah. First is the worst, but not in this case. In this case, the early bird gets the worm, and or the early bird gets to survive. Hyman, were you gonna say something?
Yeah, from like this, no religious basis for this, but like a lot of times, like whoever's younger, or if one is a parent and one isn't, like other reasons like
So,
that.
what would be the concept? Like, what's the underlying value behind that? Why would you say younger person over older person, or parent versus not parent? What's behind that decision?
Well, the
Even if
younger
it's
versus
not
older is
religious.
like who has more life left to live.
Okay.
And then if one is a parent, like how big of an effect their loss will have on the people around them.
Right, so we have to do more than just roll a die, but you're saying there might be some way we can evaluate the value of someone's life. So I mean, listen, this is a very sticky thing where you have to save one person or both are gonna die. Like, we're gonna be using expressions that we are very uncomfortable saying, but that's fundamentally what's happening here. And obviously, ideally, it should never happen that anyone has to make that choice, that we value all lives equally. But sometimes you have to make a call that one life is worth saving more than another life. All right, so that's by way of introduction. Any other thoughts on this before we jump into some sources?
Are we assuming these are like random people, or maybe like, the president?
So will you tell me, does it make a difference if they're the president of the United States versus the president of the Dominion versus someone who's a bum who couldn't even get into Michigan? Like, does that make a difference? Yeah, Deitchman.
Well, isn't it a thing that like you always have to do the Jews first, and then after that it works outwards?
Okay, what are you thinking? What are you basing that off of? Like, what are you
I don't
thinking
know.
of
I
right
learned
now?
that once. Once
Okay.
I learned that, like, when you give tzedakah, you should always give to like the people closest to you, and then the Jews before anyone else.
Okay. So you want to extrapolate from charity to saving lives.
Yes.
Okay. We'll touch on that. We'll touch on that, Ellie. But I want to go back to your question though. You thought that what's behind your question when you say, are we talking about the president? Are we talking like what are you suggesting there?
Well, first of all, potentially, if you don't save this person, will other people die?
Okay.
Also, will infrastructure break down? Like, at what? Like, there's a lot of stuff that can happen depending on if someone's around or not. And if we let the person die, they could all a lot more problems.
So what you're basically now, instead of the roll the die type of thing where it's like anyone's game, you're now leaning a little closer to what Rebecca was saying, that there may actually be a difference, that maybe you could say that this person, if we were to lose them, or we were to save this life, we could do more good than if we, or if, you know, if we, the decision might be based on where the most good will happen, which life we save. It's basically what you're suggesting. There could be chaos if the president dies, so we got to save the president. It's unfortunate that the janitor has to die, but we have to save the president before the janitor because there will be chaos if the president dies. That's basically what you're saying.
Well, it's not what I'm saying, but it's just what I'm asking.
So we'll see. We'll see. We'll see. But so that's what you're entertaining, at least the idea that you're throwing out there.
From a medical perspective, also, like, who's in worse shape? Maybe picking the person who has a better chance at living.
Okay. Well, it's a good thought also. That requires more, you know. But what you're basically saying, though, is that still there's a reason to save person A over person B. What we're driving at is away from saying random choice and suggesting that there is some thought behind who to save.
I think this also goes into like what was going on in New York a couple of weeks ago, is like when medical staff were given instructions, if they got to a site and the person was non-responsive, to not perform CPR because the hospitals were already too overwhelmed and they couldn't take any more patients. So they were told basically leave these people. And that was also happening in Italy and stuff, which is, you know, crazy that they're playing God.
Yeah. And so we're not going to touch on that this week. Next week, probably, God willing, we'll go directly into that issue of mandatory DNRs and saying we're just going to not save people. We're not going to. Normally we would resuscitate, but we're just not going to. Okay, so that being said, let's jump into these sources with that introduction. Let's start with source number one. Someone want to read for us source number one in Hebrew or in English? Or technically in English or Aramaic? Or Hebrew and Aramaic in English. Three languages. Ari, thank you for volunteering.
Okay. I'm Rabbi Yochanan, Mishum Rabbi Shimon, Ben Yehud Tzedak. Nimnu v'gamru baliyat beitz nitzaza belud kol evarot shebatara. So they counted and concluded in the attic of the house of Nitza in Lud. With regard to all the averot in the Torah, im omrin la adam avur al taharog, yavur v'al taharog. So they went through all of the averot in the Torah, and they said, if it's said to someone, you know, violate this and don't die, and violate this and not be killed, then you should go ahead and violate it and not be killed. Except for killing and forbidden relationships and I don't watch out.
Right. Okay. So they had a vote. They all agreed. Everyone. Okay. We've established 610 mitzvot. It's yavur yaharig, do the transgression. Don't be killed. There are three that are the exception for which you have to be willing to die. You have to die before transgressing, and that's idolatry, gilui arayot, and shvichut damim, and killing. So, I mean, so if someone says, I'm going to kill you, well, never mind. I'll stop that sentence there. Ari, keep going.
Vetzeach gufa minalan. So for murder itself, like where do we learn that you should be killed instead of doing it? Svarahu, dehu de'ata lekame deraba, amrli mari dorai, zil katlai lenaf lefalne, v'ilo kaltina. So a certain person came to Rava and he said, the lord of my place said to me, go and kill this person, and if not, I'll kill you. Amar lei lekatluch velo tiktual. So he said to him, you should let yourself be killed and not kill another person yourself. Mi emar didama didach didcha sumek tfei diama demade hugavra sumek tfei. So who is to say that your blood is redder? Perhaps the other person's blood is redder. Who are you to choose your own life over this other person's life?
Right. So ultimately, he's saying here, why is it that you can't kill someone to save your own life? Because who are you to say that your life is any more valuable than someone else's life? You can't make that call. Someone else's life might be more valuable, or, you know, who knows? You don't know. Who can say whose blood is redder? We're going to come to exactly what this question really means in a moment. But it's posing this question as suggesting that it's impossible to determine whose blood is redder, whose life is more valuable, and therefore you can't kill them. Any thoughts, questions, challenges with that source so far? I mean, I think what's interesting, just it's worth noting, is that this is based on Svara. There's not a pasuk, there's not a mishnah, there's not any hard source. It's Svara. It's the logical reasoning of who are you to say that your life is any more valuable than someone else's life, that you should kill them in order to save your life. The second source is a Mishnah in Ohalot, which says basically the same idea, slightly different language. Someone want to read this second source? It's a little graphic, but it's Torah. Second source, Mishnah in Ohalot. Right, Haisha shi maksha leilet. So you have a woman who's having difficulty in trouble birth. I don't know, the child is a breech, maybe the situation is such that if the baby is delivered, the mother will almost certainly die. In that case, essentially they kill the child, they kill the fetus, because it's her life comes before the child's life. But yatsarubo eino ginbo, she ain't tochin nefesh mipin nefesh. But if the majority of the child has already come out, that is to say that the child, that the fetus has reached a point when it's no longer considered fetus, but now it's considered a human, at whatever point that is, once it passes that threshold, then you can't choose one life over the other, because you ain't tochin nefesh mipin nefesh, we don't choose one life over another, which may or may not be the same concept behind the previous svara that Rabba gave, which was like, Niyemar didama didach sumak tve, who can say whose blood is redder? Meaning in this case also, you can't say before the fetus is out, it's not really alive yet. And so we'll say, okay, it's going to kill the mother, so we can kill the child in order to save the mother's life. But once it's reached this certain point, now we're talking about trying to choose between two lives, and that you can't choose. You can't choose between to kill the baby in order to save the mother. And you can't make that call.
Connected, yeah, but are the laws of Rodef connected to this? I've heard that like the laws of Rodef play a role in abortion, but do the laws of Rodef apply here? And like, I guess, like, you know, picking a life over another, that like, you know, if one person gets saved instead of another person, is that like, you know, considered, you know, the laws of Rodef, that saving somebody else is going to kill somebody else, so in order to, you know, not have the first person die, you know, let the second person die, like.
Yes, it's a good question how this plays into Rodef. I mean, it does. To what degree and how you define a Rodef can get really complicated pretty easily, meaning you have to be this child when it's being born is not intentionally trying to kill the mother. Does that mean it's a Rodef? Is there such a thing as intentional Rodef, non-intentional Rodef? What does that mean? It can get really complicated really quickly, but you're definitely onto something, that there's definitely the concept of Rodef is certainly in play, at least on some level here. Absolutely. Yeah. So the question that Scott, that a lot of these Achronim try to deal with is going back to that question of mi yemar, who's to say whose blood is redder? Fundamentally, the question is that a rhetorical question? That is to say, the answer is that no, you can't, there's no answer to that. Who can say whose blood is redder? No one can say whose blood is redder. It's impossible to know whose blood is redder. That's one option, that it's a rhetorical question, basically saying you can't make that call. Or is it a sincere question saying, in this circumstance, Rabba is telling the guy, you are unable to make the call whether your life is more valuable than Jimbo's life, who you were told to kill. But there might be a circumstance where one can make that decision. Maybe in this instance, who can say whose blood is redder? But maybe there are instances when you can say that someone's blood is redder. And so that's going to be, unsurprisingly, it's going to be a machloket. We're going to see ultimately there are two approaches. One approach is going to look at this and say, this is a rhetorical question. You can never make a decision of whose life is more valuable. Or we're going to see another position that's going to say you absolutely can under certain circumstances. So that's going to be the Noda B'Yehuda versus the Minchat Chinuch. So someone want to read for us the Noda B'Yehuda. Source number three.
Sure. I can.
Go ahead. Oh, hold on. okay. I think I just realized. Well, I don't know. Whoever, is anyone on the Google Doc right now?
Because the maybe Google Doc?
The Google Doc, if anyone's working on the Google Doc, I don't know if you're able to, I don't know if you, someone just edited the document. I can't tell what just happened. It doesn't matter. Okay, let's just continue.
I'm on the word.
Yeah, okay, but I think we're fine. Okay, keep going, sorry.
Okay. Rabbi Ezekiel there.
Source number three. No, I don't. Okay. I don't understand. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you don't have to read. That's just his biography. You can read it if you want.
Okay.
I don't understand. Yeah, go ahead.
I don't understand those who question why Maimonides permits killing a fetus only when it is a rodif, that is, a person trying to kill another person, in this case, the mother, arguing that it is not a capital crime to kill the fetus, but it is to kill the mother. And I don't understand this.
Pause there. He's saying there are people. So Rambam writes, the only time you can kill the fetus is when it has the halachic status of a rodef. It's trying to kill the mother. Right? That's what Rambam says. And there are people who are bothered by this. And they said, why would Rambam say you're only allowed to kill a fetus when it's a rodef? After all, if you kill a person, like you kill if you were to kill the mother, that's a capital crime. You could be executed for killing the mother. But if you killed the fetus, it is not a capital crime to kill a fetus. So if it's not a capital crime to kill the fetus, then why are you only allowed to kill the fetus when it's a rodef? Maybe you should always be allowed to kill the fetus. After all, if you kill the fetus, it's not a capital crime. Right? So the people are wondering, why would you say that you can only kill the fetus if it's a rodef when whenever you kill a fetus, it's not a capital crime? Keep on going.
And I don't understand this because who says that it's permissible to kill a treifa in order to save someone who is healthy, a shalim? Even though it is not a capital crime to kill a treifa, it is still forbidden to actively kill a treifa.
Meaning, you have two categories of people. You have someone who's generally healthy, a shalim, and then you could have someone who is the status of a treifa, similar to an animal being a treifa it's not projected to live more than 12 months. It's going to die within the year. So you have a person who is also in that category of treifa. They're sick with some terminal disease we don't project them to live beyond 12 months from now. That person, if you were to kill a treifa, you are not chayev. It's not a capital crime to kill a treifa. That being said, the Noda B'Yehuda says it's not permitted to kill a treifa. Just because something is not a capital crime doesn't mean that it's permitted. It just means that it's not a capital crime, but it still could be forbidden. He says that's the case for a treifa and a shalim. You can't kill a treifa in order to save the life of a shalim and say, well, look, a treifa, if you kill a treifa, it's totally fine because it's not a capital crime. It doesn't matter that it's not a capital crime. Me Yemar, who can determine whose life is more valuable? And so you can't make that call there, and you can't make that call with the fetus. The only reason you can kill the fetus is because it's a rodef. But short of being a rodef, just because it's not a capital crime to kill a fetus doesn't mean that it's permissible. Things, the world doesn't divide up into it's permissible or it's a capital crime. Something could be prohibited and not be a capital crime. And that's what the Nodibihuda is saying. Killing a fetus or killing a trefa may not be a capital crime, but that doesn't make it mutter. Any thoughts on this? Any disagreements with this? I mean, fundamentally what he's saying, essentially he's saying that that statement of mi yemar is a rhetorical question. Who can say whose life is more valuable? No one can say whose life is more valuable. Always and forever. There is no trefa, a fetus, you can't say whose life is more valuable. So, ever. You can never make that statement. That's the Nodi Bihuda's approach. Then the Chachinuch is going to disagree. Someone want to read source number 4? The Nodi Bihuda.
I can.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Okay. Killing someone is forbidden under right. under at all costs.
Under. And get rid of the under. Forbidden at all costs.
Okay. And it seems obvious that if one is being forced to kill a fetus in a way that the mother is not at risk, he is certainly not obligated to give his life for this. Or we do not apply whose blood is redder in such a situation, since the fetus is not a soul.
So what is the Minchas Chinuch saying here?
You're asking me?
Anyone. Sure, take it.
That, like, in some cases, you can decide to, like, if not a rhetorical question.
Exactly.
And in this case, it's saying that, like, it depends, the whole argument, when you consider a fetus a life is another story, but, like, it's not yet a soul, and therefore you can decide that the mother's life is valued more.
Exactly. So he's saying that, and it's funny, is that they're talking about the same basic scenario, in that the Nodi Bihuda was talking about, obviously you can't kill a fetus to save anyone's life unless it's in the status of a rodef. And here the Minchas Chinuch is saying, of course you can, you're certainly not obligated to let you're not obligated to give your own life to save the life of a fetus. You can certainly kill the life of a fetus because it's not really a life. And so he's entertaining the idea that there are certain times when we can say that someone's life, it's not a matter of, you don't have to flip a coin to make the decision of whether it should live or not. It's not really alive. So if it's going to be your life or the fetus's life, obviously your life wins because it's not really alive. Right? And any thoughts or challenges or issues that anyone has with either the Minchas Chinuch or the Nodi Bihuda, or the implications of the Minchas Chinuch and the Nodi Bihuda? Again, the Nodi Bihuda seeming to say that miyemar, like my chazi, you can never make the call of whose life is more valuable, and the Minchas Chinuch saying, well, sometimes you can make that call. All right, so we're going to come back to this machloka later on tonight. But just keep this in your back pocket to realize that when the Gemara there said who can say whose life is more valuable, that there is a machloket about whether you can ever say that someone's life is more valuable. So let's move on to the fifth Mishnah. I'm going to say there's a little bit of a trigger warning here because, well, you'll get the idea. You'll see why it's a little bit of a trigger warning, why it's hard to whatever. You'll see it in a moment. But so here we're going to see. So what happens, you have to make a call. Two people come into the hospital. We'll say Joe comes into the hospital and Jan come into the hospital. And they're both equally sick. And they're dying of the same thing. And you can only save one of them. And you know you'll be definitely able to save one of them. Which one do you choose? So here's the Mishnah in Masechet Horiot, source number 5. We'll take this one. Anyone want to read that one? Ellie, you want to read that one?
I don't have the Google Drive.
Do you want me to repost it?
Yes.
There it is. Someone else want to read this one? Mishnah 5? Source 5, Mishnah in Horiot?
All right, I got it now.
Okay.
Haria. Okay, cool. The man precedes the woman when there is uncertainty with regard to which of them to rescue or to return a lost item to first.
Okay, so Jim, so
I
Joe.
A trigger warning.
Yeah, so Joe and Jan come into the hospital at the same time. Ellie's the doctor. Ellie says, "Oh, I just learned a Mishnah. Whose life do I save? Joe or Jan?" Assuming Joe is a man and Jan is a woman, who do you save? Joe, you save Joe. Okay, let's say it's Joe and Fred. Joe is a Kohen and Fred is a Levi. Continue with the Mishnah, Ali.
Mishnah, a priest precedes a Levite. A Levite precedes an Israelite. An Israelite precedes a son born from an incestuous or adulterous relationship, aka a mamzer. And a mamzer precedes a Gibeonite. And a Gibeonite precedes a convert. And a convert precedes an emancipated slave. When do these halachot of precedence take effect? In circumstances when they are all equal in terms of wisdom. But if there was a mamzer who is a Torah scholar and a high priest who is an ignoramus, a mamzer who is a Torah scholar precedes a high priest who is an ignoramus, as Torahism surpasses all else.
All right, so it might be that the Kohen is a Kohen, but he's an idiot, and the Mamzer is brilliant. He saved the Mamzer's life. So this is the Mishnah in Horio, which gives us a clear, you can't ask for a more clear hierarchy here. Men before women, and among the category, I guess, within men, you have Kohen beats Levi, beats Yisrael, beats Mamzer, beats Kivon, beats Ger, beats Eved Meshuchrar. You got a beautiful, beautiful thing. Any thoughts on this? Rebecca thought maybe this was a trigger warning. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, saving a man before a woman, which, like, if you are valuing one person's life versus another, like, women can have children, men can't carry their own children. Maybe you should value a woman's life more.
What if there's a smart woman and a dumb man, and is always the case? Okay, so presumably it sounds like Torah scholarship comes ahead of everything. So as long as a woman is learning a lot of Torah, she's probably good to go. But yeah, so it's an interesting call that the capacity of creating life, if that's a factor here, then it's clearly not, because just because you learn a lot of Torah doesn't mean you can bear physical fruit. You might be able to teach a lot of Torah, so that's a very good thing. But yeah, it sounds like Torah knowledge is more significant than any other factor here. So that's the answer to Kushner's question over there. Okay, so this is this Mishnah. So there is not a hospital in the world, as far as I'm aware. Even the hospitals that are run by halachic rulings that follow this Mishnah. What does it give you a night? Go back to Seir. Didn't you study Sefer Yehoshua?
Oh, you need to learn Tanakh again.
Go back to Sefer Yehoshua. I don't know the parak.
I'm doing Yehoshua tomorrow night.
Good. So you'll report to us.
Are we just talking about the people? Like, are they? They're not Jews, politically speaking, right?
They're in the camp of Jews. They just rank lower than a Yisrael and higher than lower than a Mamzer, but higher than a regular convert. Yeah, they're within the category of converts, and they rank higher. I'm not sure why they would rank higher than a typical convert. But either way, source number six. Someone want to read source number six for us? We're going to see that it's just not – we don't follow this. Sarah, as the other woman in the call, do you want to read source number six?
I would love to.
Okay.
Okay. The Mishnah in Horiot is – not in practice. It is omitted in the works of Maimonides, and the Tur also admits it. And the Beit Yosef quotes this position after referring to Maimonides. What? But in his Shulchan Aruch, he omits it. It appears to me that most halachic authorities omit it.
Right, so he's saying, look, it is a Mishnah, but Rambam doesn't quote it, the Tur doesn't quote it, the Beit Yosef quotes it, but leaves it out of the Shulchan Aruch. Meaning the Beit Yosef knew about it, but it left it out. Right? So he says, look, no one seems to be accepting accepting this mission. Now, to be fair, the Rama does quote it, but as he points out in the commentaries on the Rama, it seems that the Rama, when he quoted it, he didn't quote it meaning what we all think it means. He quoted it for another point, which means that when he says that most halachic authorities omit it, he believes, and that's probably true, that the vast majority of halachic authorities say that we cannot use this mission in Horiot. Now, why it's not used could be a separate question. Is it because they find it offensive to say a man's life takes precedence over a woman? Is it because it's impossible to do? We'll see. The source number 7. And you can tell me what you think about what Rav Moshe says. But here's Rav Moshe and another tshuva. He has a point here about using this mission in Horiot. Someone want to read this, source number 7? Okay, Ari.
Obviously it is
it's
simple and
like it is known. It is a known fact.
Yeah, it's a clear, simple, known fact to any Ben Torah or anyone who has Yirat Shemayim. There's an obligation to heal and to save anyone who it's possible, any person, regardless and without any consideration of their wisdom or their knowledge. And even in the matter of proceeding one for the other. Leika Ella Bamash Natan Disov Harayot. Even with regard to proceeding one over the other, the only parameters we have are the ones mentioned in Harayot. The af Belav Kashela Sot Masa below Yun Gadol. So even with these, it's hard to do this without like a great investigation.
Right. So he's saying that we can't practice the mission of Horiot. So you can tell me, what do you think? Does he mean that it's ideally if we had some like supercomputer that could compute Torah knowledge or equate Torah knowledge, or like why does he say what does it mean that we can't do it without great investigation? What is he saying? Is he saying that he's morally opposed to it? Is he saying that it's morally, it's acceptable, but like it's just hard to do in practice? I mean, if we're going to assume that Torah knowledge really is the ultimate determining factor, then like that's really hard to do. Like two people come in, Joe and Jan come in, you're going to like, okay, let's go, give me the first Mishnah, recite the first three Mishnayot of Masechet Brachot, and see which one can say it, but they're both in a coma, like no one can. How do you determine who's, is that what he's thinking? Anyone have any thoughts on what Rav Moshe is thinking here as to why we don't practice the mission in Horiot?
Well, I mean, the things about Chachma, it's hard to determine, but like a Kohen versus Levi versus Yisrael, like that's a pretty easy thing to.
Is it?
I mean, at least to investigate.
Well, but hold on. The last time you were Mafrish Challah, did you give it to a Kohen? Did you give it to Micah? No, you didn't, because you don't know if Micah doesn't want it, that risk, because Micah doesn't know if he's a Kohen. We assume he's a Kohen. He does Birkat Kohanim. Okay. But you don't know absolutely that he's a Kohen. I think there's some story of, maybe it was the Mishnah Berurah. He did Pidyon HaBen. Like, every time he met a Kohen, he did another Pidyon HaBen. Because, like, we don't know. Like, who knows? So I'm admitted to the hospital, and Mike is admitted to the hospital. And the doctor says, okay, we're going to save Micah, but he's a Kohen. My first thing I'm going to say is, do you know he's a Kohen? Like, of course, I'm a Kohen too. I'm an Anav. I'm very humble. That's why I never took the first Aliyah. That's why I never duchen. But I'm a Kohen too. He's a Kohen? Okay. Like, how do you know who's a Kohen? So it's hard to, maybe that's what he means. Like, okay, if you have like a Kohen Meyuchas, like someone's like, hi, my name is Aaron Cohen, my brother is Moshe. Like, okay, maybe that we trust that he's a Kohen, but short of that, I don't know. To stake your life on it?
I kind of disagree. I don't think he's talking about like the specific hierarchy like that's given in the Mishnah, because first of all, it says like at the end of the Mishnah, and that's where it talks about the Torah portion. So I think that it's more like of a broad thing. And again, it's like, how do you choose whose life is more valuable? And I don't think it's regarding like the actual hierarchy that's outlined here. I think it's just like the general, like who are you to be the one to judge whose life is more valuable, just based on like the great investigation part and it referencing the end of the Mishnah.
Okay. So it's interesting is that like you're pointing out that the last line in the Mishnah sort of like undoes the entire thing before it. Like it gives like clear rules and says, but like, forget about the rules because it really has to do with Torah knowledge. And then Rav Moshe's like, yeah, but who could tell Torah knowledge? So that's ultimately what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that's
also like,
yeah,
I feel like the Gemara that says that like, a righteous non-Jew is like a Kohen Gadol.
Okay.
So that, I mean, that kind of perhaps like even takes this like even further out of the realm of possibility. Cause it's like, you know, if the whole point here is that like, you know, these things can all be overridden. Like even the differentiation between Jew and non-Jew, maybe according to that could be overridden.
Right.
If you were really trying to, you know, split hairs.
Which we might be trying to do when it comes to saving life. We want to be very precise. So maybe, yeah, that's an interesting point. I didn't think about that, but it's a really interesting point.
I also think a lot of this, like all these specific questions, like people who are coming and are in a really bad situation where you have to choose which to save, it seems like imminent danger. Like you're not going to know a lot of these things. Like, God forbid someone's in two people are in a car accident and they're sitting together. Like, you don't know if one is Jewish, if one is a Kohen, if one is a mom's there. Like, right. And you have no idea. Like, they might not be able to tell you all the Torah they know.
Right.
So, like, that could also be the great difficulty.
Right. That's true.
Like, when do we know if it was, like, Rav Schachter was in the hospital? You know, like, can we figure it out?
Yeah, but I mean, you know a lot of Torah yourself. You don't know Sefer Yehoshua, but after tomorrow night, you're going to know Sefer Yehoshua, and then you'll be great. So, like, you're, you know, a very unassuming young man. It could be that you're someone who looks, they've got a long beard and they've got a big black hat. You're like, this guy went to the University of Michigan. He might not wear a, you know, white button down shirt, but this is Harav Eli Barakat. This is, you know, I don't know. I mean, maybe, but I think. You have people who are Torah scholars who don't look like Torah scholars. There's it's an interesting piece here. So Rav Schachter himself, who Ellie just referred to, is source number 8. So he wrote a responsa, he wrote a tshuva several weeks ago about this, writing, thinking explicitly about triage related specifically to Corona. So he's source number 8. I gave you a very quick summary translation, but in English. But I think the Hebrew is actually better. So if someone wants to read the Hebrew here. Source number 8. It's Hebrew. I'll help you through it. Don't worry. Or you can read the English, and I'll supplement with the Hebrew. You want to prove that you need to be saved. Go ahead.
I didn't do that. Uve Mishnah Sof Horayot Hova Seder Kedima Batzelet Nafshot. At the end of Horayot, the order of saving lives is presented. We Sof Ita Shema Shemamzer Tacham Kedim.
It just gives it the whole hierarchy, but then at the very end, it just undoes it and says, by the way, but like whoever knows more Torah wins. Okay, continue going, Ali, the Nira.
Yehakoba ben ze hu she makdimim latzil et ze shakihila tricha lo biyoter.
So what does he think? He thinks what is behind this Mishnah in Masechet Oriot? The decision is based on who the kehila tzricha lo biyoter, who is more valuable to the community. So the Kohen is more valuable than the Levi, who is more valuable than the Israel, who is more valuable than the Mamzer, who is more valuable than the Kivoni, who is more valuable than the Ger, who is more valuable than the... It's a question of what they bring to the community. It's not necessarily about their intrinsic inherent value, but that what they can do for the community. The Kohen provides a necessity that other people can't. Kohen's an important part. If we were to update it today, maybe we'd say, and the shochet, and the rabbi, and the teacher, and the grocery store worker. And we could maybe add these, whoever, you know, person who's more valuable to the community takes precedence. Keep going, Ellie. Ayen Igrot Moshe. So take a look at Igrot Moshe.
I got Igrot Moshe.
Which we've read at the previous source.
The kase lasot mase. Filu
Alpi
Kwali Hamishna Bli Ivan Gadol.
Right, so he quotes Rav Moshe and he says, and Rav Moshe Feinstein himself said it's very difficult to actually act in accordance with the Mishnah in Horio. And then Rav Schachter has this comment in parentheses, which is not in the English translation, but I think it's a good point to point out. He says, Mistama Haitama Dahachi Ita Shemasha v'mishna she'isha kodem le'isha l'hachayot. Mistama haitama she'gvarim mekayimim yoter mitzvot me'asher hanashim. He says, look, what's probably behind? He says, what is the Mishnah thinking when it says a man takes precedence over a woman? It's because a man has more mitzvot. And so if you save a man over a woman, you'll be creating, there will be a higher level of mitzvot that are performed in society if you have, you save a man over a woman, because a woman is exempt, he says, from Mimi Misavara Sveshia's man grama. And then he points out, pick up Ellie with Ubizmanenu.
Ubizmanenu? After parentheses?
No, still in the parentheses, after the one, two, three, after the fourth comma. In the parentheses.
Oh, in the parentheses. Okay, one, two, three, four. Uvizmanenu yesh harbe nashim she'oskot batara uvemitzvot yoter me'asher gvarim v'kulam.
Meaning, okay, so maybe in the times of the Mishnah, you could assume a man was performing more mitzvot than a woman. But nowadays, what do you mean? There are women who are performing. You have men who do nothing, and you have women who do everything. So why would you make that call to save a man over a woman? That's silliness, because the woman could be significantly more valuable to the community as far as Torah observance and Torah and mitzvot and Torah learning. Keep going.
Islali Hamishna Yoskim al Hahancha Shalafi Seder Kdimot Ze Naruyah Yoter Ba'avor Hakila.
Right, so it says the basic essence, the concepts, the idea behind everything in that Mishnah assumes that there is that the higher up you are, that means the more you benefit the community more. So a person who benefits the community more ranks higher. Similar to what we were talking about earlier, by the way, that someone was saying that maybe there's a difference between the president versus a doctor versus the janitor versus some, you know, the bus driver versus, you know, is saying that, look, the bus driver honestly would probably rank much higher because the bus driver is enabling people to get back and forth. But you get the idea that there's, Rav Schachter is saying that maybe what was behind the Mishnah was what we were saying earlier, was that maybe you should give precedence to the people that society needs more because they facilitate successful business interactions, I don't know, because they maintain order and discipline in the community, because they are doctors and they can save lives, because without them the world falls apart. You know, there could be all sorts of different reasons that someone gets bumped up, but Schechter was saying that presumably that Mishnah was trying to answer and telling you save the person who the community would benefit more from.
I think it's interesting that
yeah
no you go I'll say it after
no go please
Oh, thank you, Rabbi. I think it's interesting that even like today, like that's a question. That's like the big question that's coming up is who's essential and who's important to society, because the entire status quo has been shifted drastically during the past few weeks, and who we didn't think was essential before is now essential. So I think it's interesting that, you know, even thousands of years later, they're still trying to figure out who is the essential, who's worth saving, and who isn't. And it's, you know, the person who may have thought to been, you know, not as high up thousands of years ago, like the simple like merchant who would go door to door, is now like, you know, the essential and the person who's, you know, the one going out. So it's interesting.
Right. My guess is if 5 months ago, if we were to have a conversation, we were to rank where the UPS delivery man, how essential that job is. If someone were to say, I want a job that makes a difference in the world, that's a meaningful job, and we were to put a bunch of different professions, I would imagine we would have put a lot of professions above that. But now we're realizing, no, actually that's a very fundamental, especially in our, now someone who's delivering packages, goods and services, or goods and food to people is a very important job. And that makes a big difference in people's lives. And so that awareness shifts over time. I think as things happen, people become more aware of how essential real estate magnate is way up there. Yes, very, very true. So, okay. But I think that's a good point, Josh. We're almost out of time. So I want to, well, we'll just finish up this and then we'll really quickly, maybe I'll say outside the source number 9 and we'll stop there because I don't want to take people. I also have another thing to get to and I don't want to take time from people because I want to be fair with your time. The very end of what Rav Schachter says, he says, this is Dvar zeh kasheh me'od likboa mi nitzrach lekeila yoter mimi. This is very difficult to determine who is actually more valuable in the society. Mitam zeh hamekubal etzal poskim shelo linhog al pi mishnah. And therefore, because of that, the general consensus of all authorities is to not practice in accordance with that mishnah, because there's no way to actually act in accordance with that mishnah. There's no way to know. Okay, that's now I want to do say really quickly source number 9. Source number 9 is sort of Menashe Klein, and he says, we'll read the English. He says, certainly when there are two ill people before you, you can only save one of them, right? So this is going back to Sarah's question, although we're going to, Sarah's comment before, that they're coming in at the same time. The two people come in at the exact same time, and you can only save one of them. We don't let both die, right? We can't, the decision to just say we're not going to do anything is wrong. He says, I know that because we have a mission to Horiot that details who takes precedence. Meaning, even if we're not practicing in accordance with the hierarchy of the Mishnah Horiot, the Mishnah Horiot is telling us that there is a hierarchy. Meaning, the Mishnah doesn't say, if you can't save everyone, then just let them all die. The Mishnah says, if you can't save everyone, here's who you save first, second, third, fourth. In other words, you have to make a decision of who gets saved first. You can't say, I'm going to just roll a die and randomly we'll decide who's going to be saved. You can't say, I don't know what to do, so I'm going to do nothing. You have to do something. If you do nothing, that's a violation of Lo Ta'amon Otam Reyecha. That is standing by while your brother is dying. You can't do that. You're obligated to save someone's life. Who to save? Mishnah Horiot says one thing. Everyone is saying we don't follow that Mishnah Horiot, but you have to save someone. Okay, so that's the first thing he says. Now let's say, and I didn't put, this is not there in the Hebrew, and I'm just saying this outside right now. Let's say you made a call, and the call that you made was, you made the decision that you're going to save Jan. Jan's there in the hospital. Jan comes in first, and Jan is in a much, much worse state, that the likelihood we're going to hook her up to the ventilator and she may survive, but there's a good chance that she's not going to survive. And we're going to categorize her as being a trefa. We're going to categorize her as saying, if she lives, it's going to be only for 12 months. She's not going to live a long life. So Jan's hooked up to the respirator. She's there. And now Joe's brought into the hospital, and Joe, if he gets onto the respirator, if we can save his life, and we think we can if we have a respirator, he's going to live a long life. So now you have the following situation. Jan's hooked up to the respirator. Joe needs a respirator. Jan on the respirator is going to die soon. Joe on the respirator is going to survive for a while. What call do you make? Can you remove the ventilator from Jan? And plug in Joe, so that you can save Joe's life. Jan, even with the respirator, is going to die within 12 months. Joe on the respirator can live a very long, long life afterwards. Thoughts on this?
I just think that if you're in the first scenario where you're choosing who to treat, if somebody dies, it's a much more passive act. But here you're actually removing the ventilator and you are killing Jan. And so I think in that case, even if Joe is going to live a long life and Jan won't, you don't have the authority to be able to like actually be the one to kill Jan for that respirator.
Anyone agree or disagree with this?
I agree with Rebecca. I think that was a tactic used a lot in the Holocaust by why am I blanking on the name? But the Jews that were elevated in the ghettos and told to send people off, they would first send off the sick and the elderly in order to best save the younger and the healthy. So I agree that in the initial, that doing nothing, them not doing anything, they would take the healthy and the young, and that'd be worse than taking the elderly. But in the second thing, that you'd actively be killing someone if you took Jan off life support or the ventilator.
Yeah. Okay. So it's 8:00. So I'm going to say this. So this is where what you had in your back pocket of the Noda Bihuda Mincha Chinuch comes up again. So the Rav Menashe Klein here says the following. He says, it seems in my humble opinion that I'll say this outside. But so remember the Mincha Chinuch had said, If you have a treifa and you have a shalem, you can kill the treifa to save the shalem. Sometimes you can make the call. Someone's life is more valid than the other. That was the case of why you could kill the fetus, because the fetus wasn't really alive yet, right? That's what he said. He said you're allowed to kill the fetus because the fetus is not really alive, and so you can kill it to save your life because you're a shalem. You're alive, and you can kill the fetus to save your own life. Okay. So Menashe Klein says, according to him, certainly you can remove Jan from life support. You can remove her from the ventilator. Why? Because Jan is barely alive. She's gonna live for 12, at most 12 more months. Joe, if you save him, if you attach him to the ventilator, he's gonna live a long life. So Menashe Klein says, not only says, I'll look at the Hebrew just to get the point here, says Ve'adraba Asa He says, it is permissible, according to the Mincha Chinuch, and people who agree with that line of reasoning, it is permissible to kill Jan, in order to save Joe's life. You can remove the machine from Jan to attach to Joe, and this is not, there's no hint of a sin here. The Adraba, Asa Hakol Kedat V'Chadin. And not only is it not a sin, you did everything correctly. He says, now that Joe showed up, when you remove Jan, that's a positive. When you remove Jan from the ventilator, you're saving Joe's life. If you're the Minchat Chinuch and you're the Meiri and other people agree with that, certainly you can go ahead and save their life. Remove Jan from the ventilator to save Joe's life, 100%. He says, but that's just the Minchat Chinuch. What about the Noda Bihuda? Remember, the Noda Bihuda had said, like we said earlier, Noda Bihuda said, you can never make the decision whose life is more valuable. For that, and this is the big chiddush of Rav Menashe Klein, he says, in that case, that means you couldn't, take a pillow and suffocate Jan. Hi, little Deichmans. Hello. All right, so you couldn't actively kill Jan. Removing her from the ventilator, he says. Aval nitilat ha-mechuna gam Noda Bihuda moda, but simply removing the ventilator from Jan is not killing her, even though Noda Bihuda would agree with that. If you have Joe here and you could save Joe's life and he'll live a long time, you have to save his life. All the Noda Bihuda said is that you can't kill the treifa. You couldn't kill Jan. You're not killing her when you remove her from the ventilator. You're just removing a ventilator. He says, you can't kill someone with your hands. He says, you're not killing Jan, you're just removing the machine. He says, look, you're just removing the ventilator. Maybe Jan's going to die. Probably Jan's going to die, but you didn't kill her. You just removed the ventilator. Just removing the ventilator and plugging it to Joe. That's not called killing Jan. That's called doing something to save Joe's life. Jan's going to die. Okay, Jan might die. Okay. But you're not killing her. The Noda Bihuda only said you couldn't kill Jan. you could remove the life support from her just as long as you can plug it into Joe. And that's sort of Klein's big chiddush here. I don't think we're going to see next week. We'll look at some contemporary responses. I don't think anyone agrees with that in practice. But it's an interesting idea here that he's suggesting that if Jan's going to die anyway, that her life, yeah, everyone would agree. Killing her, you can't do it. But letting her die, that you could do. And that's gonna touch on maybe what Josh pointed out earlier, that people, you know, putting people on DNR. You're not going to kill her. But if she dies, let her be stay dead. So this is going even further. You can actually remove the ventilator and give it to someone else because Jan wasn't going to survive anyway. Thoughts on this? And we'll close after this source. But any thoughts on this?
I just think with, like, modern technology, like, you know that the person is going to die if you take them off. So it's, like, kind of negligent to say, like, oh, they might die. Like, I'm not killing them. Like, I just think from a modern perspective, you kind of are.
Okay.
This is basically what I'm saying. If you cut someone, I'm not killing them. The blood loss is killing them. It's not me.
Right. Right. Interesting. I didn't kill them. I just put a hole in their chest. It was their heart that stopped pumping. That's what killed them. Okay. Yeah. Ari.
I agree with what they said. I mean, it's definitely like, considering like the ventilator works on its own. It's not like there's somebody who's like sitting there like pedaling to power it or something. So like, you know, taking them off of it does seem to be like actively doing something to hasten their death.
I'm sorry. You're right. Just
guns going.
I don't know. Is that a very Jared Kushner thing to say? I feel like he would say the opposite. Anyway, yeah. So hold on. I just lost my train of thought. Thank you for that comment there, Kushner. Hold on, Ari, what were you just saying? Say what you just said again. I lost my train of thought.
I was saying that like it's an active thing to hasten their death, whereas if you didn't touch it, like,
oh, that's
eventually it goes on its own.
Right, so there is this idea. We're probably not going to talk about it next week, but you should know that there is somewhere in the books. I don't know who initially puts this up, maybe Rav Steinberg in like Shaar Tzedek Hospital in Jerusalem. But I remember hearing this maybe when Rabbi Tatz spoke about that. I heard him speak years ago about triage and removing someone from a ventilator. And he said, I think what the policy at least was or is or contemplated being in Shaar Tzedek Hospital was that you would essentially have Shabbos clocks on a timer. No, let me say that again. You had ventilators on a timer like a Shabbos clock. It goes on for an hour. After an hour, it turns off, and it's up to the doctor to then turn it back on. So it turned off. So in that case, it's sort of like Ari, you're saying, it's not like you have someone pedaling, keeping it alive. But in this case, yeah. So the shop is, so the ventilator turned off. So at that point, it's off. And now you could move it to someone else. You're not actively removing it from someone because, I mean, you're not like taking someone off life support. Life support turned off on its own. You're a little less proactive. You're just giving it to someone else now. Now you have two people in front of you. Person A and person B. Person A was hooked onto it, and at the time that you hooked him on, it made sense for person A to be on it. But now person B shows up, and you say, well, if they had to choose between A and B, B should win. So wait, okay, A turned off, so now we'll give it to B. It's a sort of like a workaround that makes it feel a little less active to make that call. But that's something maybe we're going to talk about next week, but probably not even that much. But yeah, okay, so I've got to run. It's already 8:08. I've got to run. But thank you, everyone, for coming and learning. Just to, I guess, in some summary, this is a very complicated, difficult thing. We're going to see True Vote next week. Everyone is very scared to talk about these things because this is not like theoretical stuff, especially right now. This is, thank you, Josh. This is really practical, terrifyingly. And they're hard calls to make. I do not envy, none of us should envy the decision that a doctor has to make when making these calls, but it's worthwhile to have a look at what Jewish tradition says about this and what some of the thoughts and the factors that come into play when making this life or death situation. So unfortunately, I can't stay to answer any questions, but if you have any questions for me, you can text me or email me. We can talk about this later, but thank you all for coming and learning. And I'm going to put this up on YU Torah also. So if you have anyone who thought you would want to hear this or should hear it or whatever, you can feel free to send them the link once it's up. Hopefully it'll be up later today or tomorrow. And with that, wishing everyone, hopefully I'll see everyone back here at 10 o'clock. Not on this link. It's another link that's in the Ellie. I put it in the WhatsApp group, and so it's around somewhere. I'll stop the recording at this